I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Persons with disabilities don't always find comfort at their places of worship. This week on Intersection, Orlando religion writer Mark Pinsky joins me to discuss his new book on how to make places of worship more inclusive to people with disabilities. We'll also hear from the founder of one local ministry for disabled children. And Orlando has a new director of multicultural affairs. Luis Martinez will join me to discuss how he's engaging the city's growing Hispanic community and other minority groups in city government. That's ahead on Intersection. One in six Americans has disabilities, and yet places of worship are exempt from the Americans with Disabilities Act. Many are small, and the financial burden of making themselves accessible is prohibitive. That's the problem at the heart of Mark Pinsky's new book, Amazing Gifts, Stories of Faith, Disability, and Inclusion. Pinsky is a former Orlando Sentinel religion reporter. He also wrote the previous book, The Gospel According to the Simpsons, and he's here to talk with me about his new book. Good to have you in, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
I'm also joined by Marie Cook. Cook and her husband Tim established Nathaniel's Hope, a ministry for disabled children. The ministry is named for their own son, who was born with multiple birth defects and died before the age of five. Marie, thanks for coming in to share your story.
Thank you.
So, Mark Pinsky, you write that the number of Americans with disabilities is likely growing. Part of that, the baby boom population aging. Of course, we've got Iraq and Afghanistan vets who are returning home wounded. So, as technological advances mean more disabled children are able to survive into adulthood, what barriers still exist for people with disabilities at places of worship?
Well, they fall into two categories generally. One is architectural, which a lot of people know about. They think about ramps and the wideness of doorways, accessibility of restrooms, which are all important. But I found in my research that attitudes are really probably a larger problem at this point than our architectural barriers. We have this, as you mentioned, we're having this wave, tripartite wave of people who will be coming into our society. The veterans who may have PTSD, they may have amputations, they may have mobility issues. My cohort, the baby boomers, will be aging into infirmity with mobility and vision and hearing, not to mention mental impairment in my case. But and then we have many of these young children, or babies really, who in previous years wouldn't have survived to young adulthood. But because of advances in medical science, they are. So in the next 5, 10, 15 years, there'll be a relatively large number of people who will need some sort of assistance. And what we found is that it's really as much a matter of programs and attitudes as it is architectural barriers.
Do you think is it a question of individual experience versus a general theme of conservatism in various faiths?
No, I don't think so, because what I found, and actually I suspected that would be the case when I started my research, whereas many mainline denominations have had commissions and committees at the denominational level to help people with disabilities. Almost spontaneously, evangelical churches, many of them non-denominational, have just taken up the cause. No one had to tell them about it. They, and the Bible says the least among you. And I've been very heartened to see that in recent years, evangelical non-denominational churches have really picked up the gauntlet and become more and more welcoming and innovative, really, in lots of areas regarding accessibility.
Marie Cook, you and your husband Tim established Nathaniel's Hope at Calvary Assembly of God in Winter Park. The ministry is named for your son, who suffered from multiple birth defects. And your story is part of Mark Pinsky's new book here. What kind of barriers to worship did you and your family and your son experience?
Well, I think, the church, I know the people in the congregation loved us and cared for us, but they just didn't know what to do with us. They weren't equipped, and at the time, didn't really know how to get equipped or where to go to get equipped. And so, oftentimes it was very difficult for us to worship together as a family. And of course, our son, had multiple special needs, so he had a lot of, just a lot of issues that maybe the average person wasn't comfortable with confronting. And so they, we were loved, by people, but really not cared for the way maybe I think they wanted to care for us at the time.
And talk to me about how do you approach faith for a child so young, but also facing those disabilities and wanting to have him included in the worship?
You know, it's very hard. You know, most families that are impacted by disability have to fight for everything. They have to fight. Insurance companies have to fight, you know, for us, the school system and all that. And the church should not be a place that they should fight to have a voice or to be included. And, you know, clearly looking at the gospel, you know, we see the mandate of, as Mark just said, about reaching out to the least of these, you know, and they are a part of the body. And it's when you cut out people with disabilities, then you're kind of cutting out like the arm or the finger or a part like that. And so we have to, I agree with Mark, you know, get rid of the attitudinal barriers, you know, and the fears. I think people are just scared. They want to do something. They don't know what to do. And I think the fear factor plays a big part. They're not equipped. I don't have a special ed degree. I don't. Well, you know, when we have a child, we don't get a manual with our child when they're born with disability. And, you know, in our case, our son had an undiagnosed syndrome. So there was no book we could follow or manual. But it's like, you know, as a person willing to learn, you know, to invite them in.
Talk to me a little bit about that dynamic, too, for you and your husband as parents wanting to help your child and also seeking guidance, maybe in a spiritual way, but also at the same time realizing that there were barriers to getting everybody included in that.
Right. You know, I had a really interesting circumstance because prior to that, I had worked on church staffs for 10 years with teenagers. So I had been on the other side of it and had oftentimes seen kids with disabilities or, you know, been a part of it and thought I was doing, thought I was reaching out. It wasn't until I had my son that I realized how I really fell short of that mark, you know. And I think that I think if we can take the fear away from folks that don't understand, people want to do something, but when you can take the fear away and give them a way to help, then they'll be able to help, you know, and to do something. I think for ourselves, you know, it was difficult because we had been in leadership positions before, so it wasn't like we were just the average parishioner. We were kind of inside, you know. It was very difficult, though, to see that nobody could help us at the time, you know? And I think that's what has inspired us to try and help churches get equipped, you know, to reach out to folks with disabilities.
You and your husband, Tim, established Nathaniel's Hope in 2002 after your son passed away before the age of 5. And now the ministry provides several programs. One of them is called Buddy Break. And so this is a program where families can leave their disabled children at church with trained care providers for a few hours, give families a break and children a chance to socialize with other disabled children. Talk to me about the impact of that program and what other kind of services are out there from the ministry.
Sure. You know, we saw the need having, you know, had a child walking that journey. We saw a need how hard it was for parents to get a break. You just can't call the girl down the street to get a babysitter because they're not equipped. And oftentimes caregivers, you know, are just silently suffering, you know, just being overworked, just overstressed and everything. So it's a practical way, you know, when you talk about how do you give a person a cup of cold water, you know, to meet their need, providing respite care is a way to do it. And so families that come, you know, something as simple as going to the grocery store during a respite time where they can drop their child off and peacefully do that, you know, or maybe even taking a break. We would have a mom that when we first started the program that would go in a parking lot, recline her chair for 3 hours in her car and go to sleep because she could never get a break, you know. So I think we're meeting the practical needs of a caregiver. And if you lose the caregiver and you can't care for a caregiver, then how is that caregiver going to care for the child? You know, so we have a great opportunity and responsibility to be able to just help in a practical way, you know, and while doing that, equipping people who know nothing about disability to get comfortable with disability. We've trained top level executives, senior citizens, teenagers, all sorts of people to be able to reach out. It doesn't take a degree to do it, but just a willingness to learn.
Mark Pinsky, what are some of the issues that get opened up when you are facing starting a program to care for children with disabilities? I'm thinking that immediately there must be issues of liability and questions of level of training and those sort of barriers.
One of the points that Marie and others in the book make is that it's okay to feel awkward if you don't have a personal experience. In the beginning, that's okay. People with disabilities understand that. Their caregivers understand that. It's the willingness to go ahead. There's also a kind of motto in the disability advocacy movement, which says, don't start with elevators, because church finance committees, you know, will freeze because you're talking about $250,000 to put in an elevator. And most congregations in this country are 100 members or less. So they can put up a plywood ramp, but they can't put up an elevator. So if you emphasize that what you can do involves changes in attitude. It involves maybe modifying the services a little bit. It may mean new programs, many of which are available free from different denominations that will provide them to you. Liability is really not such a big issue. Most houses of worship carry a form of homeowner's liability. So people shouldn't be afraid. Don't start with the money stuff. Start with the things that you can do. And what we try to do in this book, there are 64 stories in the book. We try to, it's kind of a best practices volume. And so if people will read it, they'll see things to say, well, I could do that, or our church could do that, because it doesn't cost a great deal of money. It doesn't involve changing the structure very much. It just means thinking a little bit more, saying, I don't know what to do. I'd like to help. How can I help? And as Marie alluded to earlier, caring for some, I don't know, maybe many people with a disability, both children and adults, can be a 24/7 job. And that's why what Tim and Marie do is so, so important, just to give people a break to keep their marriages strong, just to survive.
Marie, how quickly did change start to happen? In terms of helping your son or trying to make accommodation in your own congregation?
You know, it wasn't until our son, passed away that we began, we knew that we wanted to do something. We kind of felt we were stewards of the circumstances we just walked through, and we knew that there was a community that really needed help and support. And we realized that respite care was a way that we could really support. And we piloted the program with Calvary Assembly and then had another church pull alongside and start to learn how to do it. And we kind of, it was a science project at the time. And we have a model now that works that has taken off for churches now, throughout Central Florida area and, in Tampa area, South Florida, all throughout the state. We have respite programs all over. It's really begun to expand, and we're in 9 states now. I think the thing is, as Mark has said, is once you get past the barriers of saying, I can't do this because, and ask the question, what can I do and how can I help, and realize that we have a responsibility to help and to make a difference. It can come along fairly quickly to start something.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFVFM. I'm talking with writer and journalist Mark Pinsky, author of the new book, Amazing Gifts, Stories of Faith, Disability, and Inclusion. I'm also talking with Marie Cook, who is the founder, along with her husband, of Nathaniel's Hope, a ministry for disabled children. I'm Mark Simpson. In what way do you think places of worship could be more accessible to people with disabilities? Tell us about it online. Go to Facebook or Twitter, or you can send an email over to intersection@wmfe.org. Mark Pinsky, what are some of the benefits for places of worship when they end up making themselves more accessible to people with disabilities?
Well, I think they're doing God's work, for one thing. Secondarily, they may be filling pews that were empty before they made their congregation welcoming and accepting. And one of the big surprises for me, the unintended consequences, the relationship between houses of worship and people with disabilities can be reciprocal, that it's not just a one-sided relationship. People have told me over and over again that they thought they were helping people with disabilities or caregivers, and they did, but they also found the gifts, which is part of the title of the book, the gifts that people with disability and their caregivers bring to them and to their congregations. There's so many things that can come, even the smallest things, can enrich a congregation, can enrich someone who helps, can enrich a volunteer, a Sunday school teacher. It just takes the desire to do it and a learning curve.
What are some of the changes, especially on that frontier, of people who are aging and the steps that churches take to make accommodation?
I think that's going to be a much lower hurdle to get over, because there'll be so many of us that if only as concern for market share, the baby boomers, as they age with vision problems, with hearing problems, with mobility problems, many of them who have retired are also relatively affluent. So by bringing them and keeping them in your congregation, you are doing well by doing good in your congregation.
And do you see, is there any particular faith that's leading the way more than any other in these areas?
No. I found in every denomination or tradition, I found so far outstanding congregations and lagging congregations. Not all the stories in my book have happy endings, at least not at first. And that's, we wanted it to be a realistic book so that not every person in every story is a super achiever or an overcomer, as they say in the disability community. These are people who cope as much as people who conquer. It's how they get through the day, how they get through the week. And in each congregation, in each tradition, from the Mennonites to the Catholics, to the Jews, to the evangelicals particularly, I found outstanding examples in every faith tradition that I encountered.
Was it hard to get people to talk to you in some of those stories where things weren't as hopeful or successful maybe as we might want to anticipate?
Surprisingly not, because I had an intro to people. I had some people from within the disability community, particularly Jeannie Thornburg, the wife of the former Pennsylvania governor and U.S. Attorney General, who spent her whole life in faith and disability. And she opened so many doors to me. And by using her name, I asked people throughout the various networks, the disability and faith networks, if they would be willing to share their stories. And they did. There's some stories were just fantastic, just knocked my socks off.
So, Mark Pinsky, you have lots of amazing stories in your new book here, and one that really caught your attention was that of Lucas McCarty. What can you tell us?
Well, here's a case of unintended consequences and the value of religious involvement. Lucas McCarty was born with a number of disabilities, some severe cerebral palsy, had mobility issues, he had communications issues. He's from the Mississippi Delta. He's white, from a relatively affluent family, and he was not really comfortable in the mainline congregation that he was, because he looked different, he made noises, and he was just not comfortable there. His grandfather operated a number of catfish farms in the Delta, and a number of the people who worked for his grandfather were African-American. One in particular took a liking to Lucas, and he went to the grandfather and he said, "You know, I think Lucas might enjoy my church." And so the grandfather said, "Fine, take him." And it was a small, poor Pentecostal church out in the middle of a field with corrugated tin for a roof. And Lucas went there, and he was immediately embraced by this congregation. Now, part of it was theological. In the Pentecostal tradition, if you shout and make noise, not a problem. If you fall to the ground, not a problem. If your body makes different movements, not a problem. It's part of their tradition. Speaking in tongues, these things made it a perfect fit for Lucas. And this poor African-American rural congregation embraced this boy, and he just blossomed. He says in the book, and actually he's the subject of another entire book, which I used for reference. He said, "You know, I'm white on the outside, but I'm black on the inside." And it just really changed his young life.
You know, you also have some stories about the Islamic faith, and you wrote about a woman named Dilshad Ali, a Muslim woman whose son suffers also from autism, and you wrote about her spiritual struggle.
It was very difficult for her. She told me about an episode during the holy fasting month of Ramadan in the Islamic tradition, when people don't eat or drink or smoke during the day, and they eat after sundown. And while her son didn't have to do all those things or didn't choose to do all those things, there was a lot of anxiety attendant around the family in that time. And one night she came home and her son was having an episode. And for all her skill as a mother, for all her love, she was unable to calm the boy down. And she told me that really caused her to question her faith. And this is not specific to the Islamic tradition. I've heard this story with other people who are parents of children with disabilities. They question their faith. They say, if I was a better Muslim, would this not have happened to me? Or would I have been able to handle it better? And you know, the answer was, of course, no. But at the moment, it caused her to have a crisis of faith. And this was consistent across the faith spectrum of the people that I spoke with. These kinds of questions in time of crisis.
And so what's the resolution?
The resolution is she and her family talked it over. The boy calmed down. The crisis passed. And she said, "It's not because I had a spiritual failure. It's not because I was spiritually weak. It's just the way the world is, and I have to accommodate myself to it as best I can."
Marie, what was your own question about your faith as you were going through this? Was there a moment of crisis for yourself?
You know, I think you asked the question why. It's hard not to ask the question why. You know, why me or why did this happen, you know? But I think for us, we started to turn it around asking, instead of asking why, we said, what for? You know, what, God, why did you put this boy in our life? What for what purpose? And we kind of came, you know, through the conclusion that, you know, our little boy was given to us to teach us, you know, he had a lot of purpose. There's power in the powerless, you know, those that the world will consider to be powerless. There's a lot of power in them and strength. And, you know, our little boy who never walked or talked or ate with his mouth taught us more in some areas than our two fully able daughters, you know, taught us about loving and sacrificial giving and, you know, and those kind of things, you know. But I think for us, ours became not so much the why, but the what for. And then our what for after his passing became that we could go out and kind of help other people that were in our shoes like that.
What are some of the small steps that you would encourage places of worship to begin with to include more people with disabilities?
Well, I think first of all, you know, you have to recognize, you know, looking around the congregation and do you see people with disabilities in there? You know, and if you find one family impacted, start with that one family. You don't have to bring in a whole big program, but begin to look at that family and find out what is their need. You know, how can we better meet the need so that this family can have a good worship experience? You know, and how do we meet the need of this individual? Because there really are no disabled souls, and these folks have a place to belong, whether it's that they can worship or they can contribute to the body as well. So it's beginning like that. You know, you can pull together a group of people to begin to talk about what the church can do. I mean, in a very practical way like that. But I think when you look at starting a program or reaching out with ministry, I think you have to begin to educate people in the congregation. I think to some people, they see somebody with a disability and they may just see the outward things that are happening and they don't understand that there's a story connected to that family. And I think raising awareness and helping to educate and letting them begin to tell their story will begin to educate the people in the congregation that they can begin to know how to reach out and what they can practically do. You know, step by step. Sometimes it's not taking care of the individual, but it's taking care of the caregiver who takes care of the individual that could be, you know, a great blessing to that family.
A word of caution in this respect. If you don't see someone in your faith community with a disability, that doesn't mean that there is no one in your faith community with a disability. When you become a welcoming and accessible congregation, you may find that there are children or siblings of people who you didn't know exist who weren't brought to the congregation because people didn't know if they would be welcome. So you don't know the extent of the situation until you take an affirmative step and step out and say, this congregation is going to be welcoming and affirming to people like that. And so in many cases of the stories I spoke with people, they didn't even know that there was a place for them. And once there was a place for them, people began to come. And if you can bring in one family member, you may end up with eight new family members because of the extended family members who will come with or because that person is made welcome.
You know, Mark Pinsky, you have such amazing stories in this book and people really bearing the essence of their character, their soul, their spiritual life to you. You found yourself asking how you might have handled some of these situations. And talk to me about that journey of introspection for yourself.
That's true. As a journalist, all of my adult life, from time to time, particularly when it involves some form of suffering or exploitation or whatever, I personalize it. I ask myself, what would I do? How would I feel? And you can't do that so much in journalism. You need to sort of find an emotional middle distance when you do a story like that. With regard to this particular book, in many cases, I ask myself, if I was this parent, if I was this sibling, would I be able to do it as well as these people have done it? Would I have measured up myself? And you, of course, the parents and the caregivers will always tell you, well, you never know until the situation is before you. So don't romanticize what we do. Don't put us up on a pedestal. We're just like you, except in this particular case. But it made me much more cognizant, much more sensitive about the situation. And also, in and around the disability community, there's the idea that, you know, you may not have a disability yet, but stick around. I mean, you know, your choices, you know, on this earthly plane are old or dead. And so at some point, disability may come into your life. So if you're sensitive to it now, you're better prepared to deal with it if and when it happens.
Advice and words to think about. I've been speaking with Mark Pinsky, author of the new book, Amazing Gifts, Stories, Faith, Disability, and Inclusion. Also speaking with Marie Cook, founder with her husband, along of Nathaniel's Hope, a ministry for disabled children. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Up next on Intersection, Orlando's new director of multicultural affairs. Hispanics are reshaping Orlando through their growing purchasing power and diversification of the workforce and locally owned businesses. Luis Martinez is the city's new director of multicultural affairs. He was appointed to this brand new position, which was created in January. Martinez joins me to discuss how he's been reaching out to Hispanics in Orlando and the area around. Good to have you in.
Thank you for having me.
You're the first multicultural director for the city of Orlando. Your goal to engage Hispanics in city government, encourage investment, expansion from Latin America in the city. So how have you been doing that?
Well, as you know, the Hispanic population is one of the largest and growing minority populations in Central Florida and Orlando. I have been involved with the community for the last 10 years, so the Hispanic community know me very well. How I am doing? Well, I am meeting with local community leaders in order to hear and listen from them what are the issues, needs, and concerns the Hispanic population has.
Why do you think this position needed to be created? Was there a sense of a gap or not quite as strong a connection as Hispanic businesses would like to see with the city?
No, I think it's about time, you know, because as I mentioned, the Hispanic community is growing every single day. People from different Latin American countries, including Puerto Rico, is moving to Orlando by creating small businesses, by creating jobs opportunities. And I think that it is important that the mayors of Orlando has someone who can reach that specific ethnic city.
There are other cultural communities within Orlando. There's the African-American community, Vietnamese, other minority groups. Are you reaching out to engage with them as well?
Yes. The purpose of my position is to create a community outreach initiative, not just with the Hispanic community, but with other minority groups, such as Haitians, Asian, among others. I have been honored to meet different community leaders from other minority groups, and my office is working hard with them in order to establish community outreach and to help them also to grow as well.
What are the challenges of this new position and this new direction for the city of Orlando?
I think the challenge is to unify the community, unify the Hispanic community and other minority groups, because even though the Hispanic community speak Spanish, one language, we come from different part of the planet, so we speak differently. We need to find ways to reach them in order to they understand the message, in order to fit their needs, their concerns, and find solutions.
Luis Martinez is the new director of multicultural affairs for the city of Orlando. That's a brand new position started in January of this year. Luis, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.